Standard Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, hundreds of thousands of Wisconsin residents who filed for unemployment amid the COVID-19 outbreak still haven't received their checks. We'll talk to a reporter about the controversy surrounding that delay. First, green, purple, white, skinny, medium, thick, asparagus comes in a lot of different ways. And there are also many, many delicious ways to prepare those long veggie spears in the midst of asparagus season here in Wisconsin. David Tanis joins us now for Food Friday with lots of asparagus advice. David has worked as a professional chef for decades, including years at Chez Panisse in California and Cafe Escalera in New Mexico. He's written a lot of acclaimed cookbooks, too. His most recent is David Tanis Market Cooking. David's a regular food columnist at the New York Times. His multimedia guide, How to Cook Asparagus, appears on the Times cooking website. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, tell us some about the varieties of asparagus. We see the green stuff for the most part. I have encountered purple in my life. I don't think I've ever laid eyes on white asparagus, though. Tell us the different colors and how we get them.
Well, you know, white asparagus is more common in Europe than it is here. Although imported asparagus from Peru lately, they've been sending some small white asparagus. But white asparagus is kind of a different animal. It usually has a tough skin that needs to be peeled, and you have to cook it for quite a bit longer until it's soft all the way through. But it's really delicious. But I think green asparagus or purple tinged is what most people in the States are going to find.
And you, in your piece on asparagus, corrected a misunderstanding I had. I thought skinny asparagus was picked younger, and if you left it in the ground, it would turn into thick asparagus. I was wrong.
Yeah. You know, it takes a while for an asparagus bed to mature. And when this bed is first starting, you get skinny ones. And the more mature beds throw larger spears up.
Interesting.
But it doesn't really matter whether they're thick or thin. The thing that's most important with asparagus is that it's fresh. And there's a huge difference between freshly picked asparagus and some stuff that's been hanging around.
Now, when we're shopping, you know, farmer's market's probably going to be pretty fresh. When we're at the grocery store, though, how do we judge what is going to be good asparagus?
Well, I mean, you need to look at it. You got to look. It should be smooth, shiny, and firm. There should be no little wrinkles or withering. You want the tips at the, to be tight. You don't want them open at the top. And you check the bottoms and see whether they look freshly cut or not. And if they're very brown, they probably weren't freshly cut. So your best choice is always going to be whatever's local.
And when it comes to cooking asparagus, we're going to talk about a lot of great ways to prepare it. You've got a surprising variety, actually, but it seems like a really easy way to make bad asparagus, and I've done this on my own in my life, is overcooking it. If people have bad memories of asparagus, it seems like 98% sure it was probably because it was overcooked. Do you think that's about right?
I think that's true. It's always a little bit sad when it gets overcooked. You want it to stay green, and once it sort of veers into that olive drab territory, then you're sort of in trouble. It's not the end of the world, but it's not as good as it should be.
We're talking.
If you've ever had canned asparagus, you know what I mean.
Definitely. We're talking to David Tanis on this edition of Food Friday. He's giving us cooking advice on asparagus. You can join in if you have a favorite or a question at 800-642-1234. Well, let's start at the opposite end of the spectrum, David, from that overcooked raw in salads and things like that. What kind of asparagus do we want and how do we prepare it?
If you want to make a raw asparagus salad, there are two ways to go about it. One is to use thick asparagus that you peel slightly at the bottom to get rid of any tough skin, and then slice very thinly with a knife or with a mandolin. Another way to go would be to go with skinny pieces and just cut them into short lengths and dress them. But it makes a nice salad, thin ribbons of asparagus just lightly dressed with something tasty, or the chopped, it can be good too.
And one of the recipes you have up at the New York Times that we'll focus in on now is a shaved asparagus salad with ginger and sesame. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Okay, well, it's basically the same thing we were just talking about.
Yeah.
So we call it shaved asparagus. That sounds fancy. It means cut very thin into ribbons. Some people do it with a vegetable peeler. I just usually use a knife. And then the idea is just to dress it lightly with something tasty. So that could be salt, pepper, lemon juice, and olive oil. Or in this case, it's with a dressing that's made with sesame oil and grated ginger, which is really tasty and bright. And that tastes good against the sort of grassiness of the asparagus.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Sturgeon Bay. John, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. So a question. We pick wild asparagus around our home in Door County. You know, we find them in the ditches and fields on certain places. Recently, I was in the National Forest up by our cabin in northern Wisconsin, kind of in the middle of nowhere. I was on a river trip, and I found an asparagus plant, had some coming up, kind of in really in the middle of nowhere. And my question is that, do you think that was from an old, maybe an old farmstead or cabin at some point, or could that just crop up and grow anywhere? And it was just kind of, you know, by chance it happened to grow there.
Interesting. I don't know if you're a wild asparagus connoisseur, David. I'm trying to look up some information about that right now. But is there a thing for, I don't know, in the cooking world for wild harvested asparagus?
Oh, yes. And if you get, you're a very lucky man. if you're finding wild asparagus, you can find it usually growing along, you know, riverbanks or irrigation ditches, that sort of thing, or, you know, someplace moist. Often you can find it, you'll see it against a fence in a pasture sometimes where there's an irrigating ditch or canal nearby. A lot of it is because it has been planted or the seeds scattered from a farmstead. But there is actually wild asparagus that just grows by itself, and it can be very, very tasty. In Spain, they're very big on wild asparagus. The wild asparagus in Spain, though, tends to be kind of long and a little bit more bitter than cultivated asparagus. It's really delicious.
Thanks for the call and happy hunting for that wild asparagus. So let's go to Derek now in La Crosse. Derek, hi.
Hey.
What'd you want to tell us about Derek?
I just want to say when I was little, my mom used to go into the ditch and pick wild asparagus, but I remember that all the time. But anyway, I was talking about how to cook grilled asparagus, and you lightly drizzle olive oil with a little bit of salt, and you just grill it until it gets some good grill marks on it, and it's very good that way.
Derek, thanks a lot for the call. And David, I think in your piece on this, you mentioned that thicker asparagus is ideal for grilling. Can you talk about grilling our asparagus a little bit?
Yeah, the bigger ones are ideal, but as long as it doesn't fall through the grates,
right.
you can grill any size asparagus. And it is it's a nice way to cook asparagus. But if you happen to have asparagus growing in, on the riverbank there, just take it home. Throw it into boiling water for 2 minutes and eat it with butter. That's the best.
For that fresh, wild stuff. And that reminds me, you mentioned the boiling water. You talk in some of your recipes about blanching asparagus for some of the salads. So it's not quite raw, but it's not too far past raw. How do we blanch our asparagus?
Well, blanching just means cooking in boiling water for just a couple of minutes. You want to keep it firm, then you're ready to use it. You can either just go from the boiling water to the platter and add the sauce or whatever you're going to use, the hollandaise, the melted butter, the vinaigrette, or if you're not going to use it right away, You can bathe it in ice water just for a brief minute to stop the cooking, and that'll keep the color green as well.
It's Food Friday. We're talking with chef and cookbook author David Tanis. We are cooking with asparagus today, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite ways to cook with and or eat asparagus? Have you ever tried one of David's asparagus recipes? By the way, you can find a bunch of recipes at the New York Times website. We've got a link at wpr.org/centraltime. Do you have a question about how to cook asparagus or maybe what's gone wrong for you in the past? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our Food Friday talk about asparagus with New York Times food columnist and acclaimed chef David Tanis. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite way to make asparagus? You get excited this time of year when the fresh stuff, the local stuff, is around and abundant. What do you like to do with it? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Anne is with us in Jefferson. Anne, hi.
Oh, hello there. I just wanted to tell you that my favorite way of cooking asparagus is ultra, ultra simple. You just heat up olive oil in a frying pan, black skillet, you know, iron pan or whatever, and maybe throw in a little butter, and then just chop the asparagus up in little pieces, you know, inch or so, and just throw them in that hot oil and saute them. Keep turning them constantly with a spatula, and then before you serve it, dump lemon pepper on it. Sprinkle lemon pepper and maybe a little cheese if you want to. It is so good. They get a little crispy on the outside.
Yep.
It is really good. And this is, we get all this from an old fence line of, it was like 3 acres of asparagus. My husband's late mother planted back in the 50s. And she sold enough asparagus off of that to put her kids through college.
And thank you so much for sharing that story. That's great. And that's pretty close to how I eat my asparagus. My family loves it. David, cast iron skillet, olive oil, get it just turning a little black in places. Then I just do salt and pepper and easy peasy.
Yes.
It doesn't take much to make good asparagus, does it?
No, sounds fine. That's a really good way. The main thing to know about asparagus is, and I'm really liking to hear all these stories about people picking wild asparagus and knowing where to get it, because that is really the best. But the main thing to know is that asparagus really is a seasonal vegetable, and it's best to eat it right now when it's in season, because in the wintertime, it just doesn't have the same appeal, and it's coming from a long way off. So, but cast iron skillet, good way to go.
Thanks again for that call. Before we get back to our callers, David, I should ask about the asparagus snap. You know, I used to cut it, and then I heard, no, you break it, and it'll break in the right place. But there's a little bit of a technique here. How do we snap it so we get off the woody stuff and keep the good stuff?
Yes, well, you just have you need to use two hands. And you want to make sure that you're down toward the tough end and snap just at the spot where the tender part meets the tough part, because if you just sort of casually snap it, it might snap too high up on the stem and you'll lose some stuff. But if you don't feel like snapping, there's no harm in using a knife to cut off the ends. It's just you may end up with a little piece of tough asparagus at the bottom of the stalk. No big deal.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us now in Sun Prairie. Bob, hi.
Hey, I just heard you talking about doing asparagus on the grill. And I get my asparagus actually from a truck garden out by Oregon. And when I want to put it on the grill, I found something that works really nice is one of these carbon fiber grill mats. It's just a thin piece of material. It's sort of resembles screening, but it's you can lay that on your grill and put your olive oil and your seasoning on there and cook whatever vegetables, not only asparagus, but It's really a handy way to cook a lot of vegetables on a grill and not have to worry about them falling through the grates.
Oh, thanks. That is a great idea, because that's a sad moment when you lose some of that asparagus. You know, you watch it burn up in the charcoal. Have you worked with a mat like that, David, on the grill?
Yeah, it's a good way to go. It's a good thing to do.
Fantastic. Thanks for that suggestion. We've got an email question from Grant who asks, has the guest ever made asparagus pesto? And what advice or recipes, if so, do you have? So asparagus pesto, is that a thing, David?
I think it may be a thing. but it's not a thing in my repertoire, I have to say.
My concern would be, I mean, it might be so covered up by all the other flavors in the pesto. Would you even remember that it was asparagus by the time you were done with it?
No, I think it actually sounds quite good. I think you'd have to be very careful to cook the asparagus quite briefly and keep it bright green. Then you could go with the usual pesto ingredients, a little parmesan, a little garlic, a little olive oil, and pine nuts or walnuts or no nuts.
Thanks for that, Grant. We'll go now to Dan on the line in Blue River. Dan, hello.
Yes, I wanted to mention a rather unusual situation. I was burning a prairie near an old garden where there was an asparagus patch. And after I was all done, I walked through and I saw about 6 or 8 inch spears of cooked asparagus coming out of the ground, which I ate, and they were wonderful.
Right on the spot?
Just didn't have any butter with me, but...
That sounds great. It's going to be a little hard to replicate in your average home kitchen, Dan, but that sounds fantastic. I love it. Well, before I go back to our callers, David, I want to check out another recipe that was up on the New York Times website. Let's look at the stir-fried spicy asparagus. Asparagus great in a stir fry. Actually, my wife did a stir fry the other day with some asparagus in it. I had it for lunch today. What's this one looking like?
Well, the thing of it is that a lot of people think that asparagus is so delicate that you really oughtn't to mess with it, not add any strong flavors. But in fact, it can really stand up to a spicy sauce. Quite well, and it's kind of nice to have that combination of the sweet asparagus and the spicy sauce. This particular one is basically, fresh hot chilies, garlic and ginger, and finished with a little cilantro. But it's a really, and of course, it's a fast hot stir fry. In that wonderful way that the Chinese treatment of vegetables can be, very fresh tasting, very bright, very green.
Talking to David Tanis. He writes for the New York Times. He is a chef and cookbook author. It's Food Friday, and we're cooking today with asparagus. Back to your calls now. Donald is with us in Iron River. Donald, hi.
Yes, I would like to freeze some asparagus for my garden. And do I blanch it first or throw it right in the bag? And if I blanch it, do I use salt in the water?
Ooh, freezing asparagus. Any advice, David?
Oh, I think you would blanch it. I don't have much experience with freezing asparagus. I think you should just cook it and eat it is what I would like to do. But I would say cook it on the very, very firm side. And cool it in ice water, and then blot it quite dry before you freeze it.
And Donald, if you're dealing with an overabundance of asparagus, just drop it off at our studio, and we'll make quick work of it, I think. One more caller I think we have time for, Jan in Wayside. Jan, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
As far as, you guys are talking about the wild asparagus, looking for it in ditch lines. I don't believe I heard anybody mention, you have to look for last year's stalks that grow up tall. I think they go to seed.
Yes, they're just like dead
brown vegetation, like the ditch is always full of dead grass, but if you you kind of learn to look for the kind of real fine, wispy, brown dead vegetation, and if you find those and look down below, you'll find the fresh shoots growing out of the ground.
Fantastic. A good warning sign, Jan. Thanks a lot for that tip. Well, David, I got to ask. Now, I love asparagus best when it's fresh, but my motto in the winter is okay asparagus is better than no asparagus. So in the off season, do you have a suggestion for the way to cook that asparagus? You know, that's not at peak, but it's looking okay at the store. come on.
I have to tell you, I never do, but if you must, I think maybe roasting is a good way to go. Dressed with olive oil, salt and pepper, and tossed in on a sheet pan in the oven at a high temperature, and you get something approximating grilled asparagus, and it's pretty good.
And then, as a counterpoint, David, in our last minute or so, is part of the fun of a vegetable like asparagus the fact that it's so seasonal and that it's something we can anticipate, look forward to?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it means the season has changed. I mean, it's like if you it's something to celebrate, and that's part of the nice thing about it. It's only available really for a few short weeks, and then there's next year to look forward to.
Well, David, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. A pleasure.
That's chef and cookbook author David Tanis. He writes a regular food column at the New York Times. He has a virtual guide on their food website, How to Cook Asparagus. You can find links to the recipes we talked about on WPR.org, where those New York Times cooking pages apparently will be free to access for a short period of time. Coming up after the news, we'll learn more about the political fight surrounding delayed unemployment checks and nearly 700,000 claims from Wisconsin residents. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Twitter added fact-checking links to two tweets by President Trump on Wednesday, leading to a backlash from the president. We'll talk about what's behind the move and what we know about Twitter's plans for fact-checking misinformation more broadly. First, between March 15th and May 23rd, roughly 2.4 million claims were filed for unemployment as businesses closed during the COVID-19 pandemic. Of those, 720,000 claims have not been paid, according to recent data. The delay in paying state residents their unemployment has become a political issue, with Republican and Democratic lawmakers blaming the other side. Republicans argue the Evers administration has been too slow to respond to the needs of Wisconsinites. Some Democrats have blamed laws put in place by GOP lawmakers in the past. Laurel White is state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, first things first, what have we heard about why these payments, these checks have been delayed?
So you touched on it a little bit there. I think there are different narratives coming from either side of the aisle in Wisconsin. So it kind of depends on who you ask. The Evers administration has said, and Governor Tony Evers himself has said, that they are working as hard as they can to fill all of these claims in a timely manner. Of course, we know we're dealing with a really almost unprecedented number of unemployment claims in Wisconsin right now. Last month, we had an unemployment rate of about 14% in the state. That's a number that we haven't seen since the Great Depression in Wisconsin. The State Department of Workforce Development actually put out some numbers on Friday, last Friday, that said in the week previous to that, the prior week, they had had 3 million calls to their unemployment call center just in that 1 week about claims or questions about claims. So this is a really huge influx, obviously, and the state is working to deal with it. the Evers administration has pointed out, and they had an opportunity to do that this week during a public hearing at the Capitol. We're not getting a ton of those these days, but there was one this week to talk about unemployment. And they pointed out that they've extended call center hours, and they're actually looking to hire 1,300 more people to work at the call centers. That's kind of a, you know, you can't hire 1,300 people overnight. They're several hundred in. They've got several hundred more to go. But they say they're kind of taking steps. Now, on the other side of the argument are Republican lawmakers who control the state legislature, and they're saying that basically these steps haven't been enough. They're saying the administration hasn't moved quickly enough to hire new people, that they should have seen this surge coming back in February and kind of made steps like some other states have to get more people on board to answer the phones. They've also talked about extending call center hours even further than has already taken place. So the extension that's happened already is they moved it from taking calls up until 3:30 in the afternoon to taking calls until 5 p.m. What Republicans want is essentially a 24/7 call center situation until this gap is filled. But for a variety of reasons, the Evers administration says that's just not possible.
I want to give a listen to one of those Republican lawmakers, State Senator here, Steve Nass.
To me, it seems there's no urgency from the department to work the 24 hours a day to get these payments done.
And that's that lack of urgency Republicans are saying they're seeing from the Evers administration and cabinet officials and more. Are we hearing this from a lot of Republican lawmakers and leaders?
We're definitely hearing it, especially from prominent Republican lawmakers. We've heard it from the majority leader. We've heard it from the speaker. I think one of the most frequent commenters on this issue has actually been Representative John Nygren, who's co-chair of the State Budget Committee. We talk about him a lot when we're talking about state budget negotiations. He started sending out and press statements several days ago. Over the past couple weeks, actually, of kind of saying, I don't like the way that this is going. These claims haven't been paid. You kind of mentioned those numbers earlier. I mean, between mid-March and late May, there were 2.4 million weekly claims. Of those 2.4 million, according to data that came out last Friday, 728,000 haven't been paid. So that's about 30%. And Nygren was really highlighting that number and saying, look, there's a big problem here and something needs to be done differently.
We're talking to Laurel White, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, about unemployment compensation here in the state. Many claims over the last couple of months unpaid so far. We had a Department of Administration Secretary Joel Brennan on the show last week to talk about the new rental insurance grant program, actually, but we also asked him about the delay in unemployment payments. Here's some of what he had to say.
Unfortunately, when it comes to unemployment insurance, it's one of the least updated and the worst in terms of the infrastructure. It's in some ways a 50-year-old system and still using very old technology. And so we've had to make some adjustments on the fly for that. We have also moved significant numbers of people over to be working on all the unemployment insurance claims. We have engaged call centers in this. So we are doing everything we possibly can. But the fact that there are still people out there who have not received their unemployment benefits is something that keeps us up at night.
What do we know about that system? He mentioned a 50-year-old system, he said, of processing these unemployment claims.
That's a huge part of the conversation about unemployment in Wisconsin right now. So the system itself is called COBOL, and it has been around for several decades now. And Democrats and the Evers administration say that it's a big part of the delay, just a kind of an older system, an antiquated system. During his testimony in this public hearing, Department of Workforce Development Secretary Caleb Frostman used those exact words. He said that essentially it's antiquated and then it's kind of hamstrung the department in moving quickly. Now, the Republican response to that is that COBOL is used by a number of Fortune 500 companies. It's used for a lot of ATM systems worldwide. And so the system shouldn't be something that is holding the state back. it's an interesting conversation too, because another thing that kind of is brought up when they're talking about the technology at DWD and the technology that they're having to use to file these claims is that there was actually a report from the department that came out in 2014 talking about some of the technical limitations that they were facing in processing unemployment claims at that time. So Democrats are saying, look, Republicans have been in charge of Wisconsin state government since 2011 in terms of, you know, state spending, having the majority that makes the decisions about the budget. Why, when this system was flagged as, you know, creating some problems back in 2014, wasn't there more money put in a modernization of the system? So Democrats are really saying, we've had signs leading up to this point that we could have problems with unemployment, and you haven't made it a priority. And it's sort of set the administration up to fail right now when they're having such a huge influx.
And digging into the meaning of the numbers we're hearing here, 2.4 million claims filed, 720,000 claims not yet paid, that it doesn't add up to 2.4 million people and 720,000 people, right? One person might file multiple claims over a course of weeks.
Right, right. So those are weekly claim numbers. So I think it's really easy to kind of have a little slip of the tongue and say 2.4 million people or 728,000 people, but these are actually individual claims, and one person could be making multiple claims, of course.
And then part of the process here is these claims have to be approved, right? There are measures mm-hmm. to make sure they're not fraudulent, to make sure people are eligible. That's part of the story. Is anybody saying that's part of the slowdown?
Well, I think that's definitely, again, kind of part of the conversation. I mean, there are certainly checks in place and things that have to be done procedurally to make sure that people are qualifying for the benefits that they're receiving. I think the state put out some data and said that of the 2.4 million claims, I think about 11% have been denied of those. There are some kind of procedural things that have created trouble for one specific set of individuals that haven't gotten claims yet. And those are people that are newly eligible for unemployment during the pandemic under this new federal program, people like self-employed individuals or private contractors. And they're trying to claim unemployment through a program called PUA. And basically, the state had to come up with a new system to support and process and make sure they got all of those things kind of checked off the list to make sure that people were eligible. And rolling out that technology in Wisconsin has been difficult, challenging, took about a month actually between starting to get those claims and paying them out because of some of those technological challenges. And that was about 88,000 people. So we can specifically point to that group and say, you know, getting the checks in place for that group created a delay.
And as we wrap up, Laurel, what are we watching for next as the state tries to catch up?
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see. You know, we're keeping a close eye on how they continue to change the workforce at DWD, bringing on more workers. As I said, they've hired several hundred people. They're looking to hire several hundred more, and just see what the debate looks like in terms of maybe increasing those call center hours more and what the administration does to respond to the criticism from Republicans.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Laurel White is state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She joined us today to talk about the delay in unemployment checks arriving for people who filed claims and the state government response. Coming up, Twitter is getting criticized on many sides this week after fact-checking two of President Trump's tweets. We'll talk about the latest and get a closer look at what goes into fact-checking. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the author of a new book about a Door County summer camp shares stories of Peninsula State Park's early years. Now, Twitter continues to get pushback after its move Wednesday to do a form of fact-checking of President Trump's tweets. The two tweets from the president contained false information about mail-in voting, and in addition to criticism from conservatives, some from the world of journalism are criticizing Twitter for a lack of transparency about its process and standards for fact-checking. Lucas Graves is an associate professor of journalism at UW-Madison and author of the book Deciding What's True, The Rise of Political Fact-Checking in American Journalism. Lucas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. It's good to be with you again.
Well, we've talked to you in the past about newspaper outlets and groups doing these fact-checking things. What do you think of this venture from the prominent social media site Twitter to do this bit of fact-checking?
Well, first of all, I was really surprised by it. I mean, critics have been calling on Twitter to take action against false and misleading and sometimes dangerous tweets from the president for many months. And I think no one expected them to finally do it. On balance, it's really good to see them take this step. I think that, you know, politicians with millions of followers should be the first in line for fact-checking instead of being exempt from it. But as lots of people noted, you know, Twitter could have been a bit better prepared if they were going to start fact-checking the president.
Right. There are lots of things said on Twitter. Many of them are false by various people. Do we have any sense that Twitter has a procedure here, a way that they're going to be going out and prioritizing who to fact check, how they're going to do it, that kind of thing?
It's kind of hard to tell. I mean, they made a sort of string of updates to their policies over the last 6 weeks, the last couple of months. This was clearly fueled by concerns over misinformation related to COVID-19 and to the, you know, the coronavirus pandemic. The pandemic has made clearer than ever how dangerous misinformation can be. And of course, you know, the president has made a lot of well-known false pronouncements about potential cures. He's done that on Twitter. He's also done it at his press conferences. But I think that that's really increased the pressure on platforms like Twitter to police misinformation and to take this bold step of, you know, of fact-checking the president. But it does seem like they're sort of making policy on the fly. You know, there's a saying that you shouldn't build the car while you're driving it. And it definitely feels like they're already shooting down the highway here. You know, I think if you're going to start fact-checking the president, especially one who's as combative as President Trump, you want to have really clear policies in place around who qualifies for fact-checking, around what form the fact-checks will take. And you also want to, you know, publish your methodology and have some in-house expertise about using sources to carry out these fact-checks, or else maybe partner with outside fact-checkers the way that Facebook has done. So as lots of people have pointed out, you know, Twitter's been a little bit inconsistent in how it fact-checks different public figures. And it's kind of hard to figure out what their, you know, what their policy is.
Speaking of Facebook, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has criticized Twitter for this decision. Here's some of what he had to say Wednesday on CNBC.
But I don't think that Facebook or internet platforms in general should be arbiters of truth. I think that's a kind of a dangerous line to get down to in terms of deciding what is true and what isn't. And I think political speech is one of the most sensitive parts in a democracy, and people should be able to see what politicians say. And there's a ton of scrutiny already. Political speech is the most scrutinized speech already by a lot of the media.
In this case, people could still see what the politician had to say. What do you think about the approaches Facebook versus Twitter?
You know, I have to say first about those remarks from Mr. Zuckerberg. I mean, those are really disingenuous remarks, in my opinion. All of the First Amendment concerns that have been raised around Twitter's move are really a red herring. You know, Twitter's a private company, and the First Amendment protects against censorship by the government. And more importantly, they haven't censored Trump. They simply added context to his tweets. You know, they're adding more information. That's exactly the kind of discourse that the Bill of Rights, you know, was designed to protect. But beyond that, all of the platform companies regulate our speech all of the time. They just have been reluctant to do that when it comes to powerful figures who, you know, who can endanger them, who can call them before Congress and such. And so Facebook, you know, has been fact-checking sort of false information that circulates. They police hate speech. they have really strict and extensive policies around what can be said on their platform. So these are complicated questions, but it's not as if anyone is not regulating what people say on their platforms.
Talking to Lucas Graves from UW-Madison, author of the book Deciding What's True, The Rise of Political Fact-Checking in American Journalism, looking at Twitter, President Trump, and fact-checking. I want to read a little bit or a couple pieces of the tweets in question here. The president wrote, there is no way, zero, that mail-in ballots will be anything less than substantially fraudulent. Mailboxes will be robbed. Ballots will be forged, even illegally printed out and fraudulently signed. The governor of California is sending ballots to millions of people. Anyone living in the state, no matter who they are or how they got there, will get one. Well, I want to look at the difficulty of fact-checking. The last half of what I read there is not true. They're sending it to registered voters only, so that's pretty easy. But a claim that something will happen in the future, how do fact-checkers, I know you've been in the trenches with them, how do they deal with a speculative statement like that?
I mean, that is really difficult. There's some people who say you can't possibly check any claim about the future. I don't quite agree with that. The best way that you approach a claim by that and the way a claim like that and the way that fact checkers have approached it is by looking at the record. So what we do know is that, the record of fraud around mail-in voting and frankly, the record of voter fraud in general, suggests that it's not the sort of serious concern that, that some critics want to claim that it is. As we know, there are states that rely entirely on mail-in voting, like Oregon. And in other places, we've heard President Trump and other Republican Party figures explain exactly what their real concern about widening the franchise in this way is, and that's that it'll hurt them at the ballot box. You know, President Trump himself said that if we adopted mail-in voting, vote in widely, no Republican would ever win again. I don't think that's actually true, but clearly that suggests that their concern is a political one. But so that's how fact-checkers approach it. They look at the best evidence that they can find. They acknowledge where there are holes in the record, where there are uncertainties. They talk to experts, academic experts or people from think tanks. They disclose the political leanings of these experts if they have any. And they always make a point of showing their work so that even if you disagree with the final verdict that they reach, at least you can see how they got there. And hopefully the information they supply is still useful, right? They're adding context to these complicated questions.
In our last minute or so, as you say, Twitter is kind of inventing their process as they go, or so it seems. Do you have places where you point people toward for good, solid fact-checking with a consistent record?
I think the leading U.S. fact-checkers, simply because they've been at this for so long and they've weathered so much criticism, they do a pretty good job of it. So, PolitiFact, for instance, publishes its methodology. They publish all of the sources that they use with each piece, with each fact check in a separate sidebar. They carry corrections when somebody points out a mistake they've made. They have clear policies around that. And they and other fact checkers subscribe to an international code of principles, which is maintained by the Poynter Institute, which is a journalism education hub. So I think that would be a great resource for Twitter and for other platform companies as they try to implement fact-checking in-house.
Lucas, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
My pleasure.
That's Lucas Graves. He's an assistant professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of the book Deciding What's True, The Rise of Political Fact-Checking in American Journalism. He was with us today to talk about Twitter's decision to add fact-checking links to a couple of the president's tweets, along with a few others in recent days. You can let us know what you think. There's a long conversation, I think, still up there at the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can join us at the scene of the incident over at Twitter. Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know what you think about all of this. Why did the salamander cross the road? To get to the pond on the other side. We found out about that yesterday here on the show with an expert on amphibians from Wisconsin's DNR. But how did the salamander cross the road? Sometimes with a little bit of help. Eva Marley with Audience Services here at Wisconsin Public Radio shares a story with us about helping out during a salamander migration.
When I heard the interview yesterday about salamanders, it reminded me of warm summer nights spent with my dad trying to help the salamanders that lived in the pond by our house cross the road safely. When the conditions were just right, when there was just the right amount of rain and moisture in the air, and it was just dark enough, we'd drive out to the pond, pull over, my dad would leave the headlights on, and slowly you'd start to see these little creatures start to crawl out onto the road. And we'd see reflections of the headlights reflected in their eyes. You might see little flashes of red or yellow from their spots. We'd pick them up in our hands, and they'd be wriggling and squirming. And then we'd drop them off in the grass softly so that they could get to the pond.
That was Eva from Audience Services here at Wisconsin Public Media sharing her story about helping out during a salamander migration. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.